Okay. Right, okay. Where are we? Let me just mute everybody. We're ready to rock and roll. Okay. Now, this is the Shir Ilu Nishmos Mefran Shmuel Ben Avram Arya Cohen Nechai Tova Bath Eliezer Mendel HaKohen on the Book of Yechezkel. We're right at the end of chapter 11, which is, and we're up to verse 20. Hopefully we'll finish chapter 11 today. Verse 20 is a very strange verse. It deals with a few verses of Nechama, of comfort, at the end of a very dark chapter. And it describes that at the end of days, when the Yetzer Hara has been removed from the world, then Laman, this is verse 20, Laman b'chukosai yelechu, they'll follow my statutes, v'esh mispotai yishmeru, and keep the Torah. And they'll do them, actively keep the Torah, and they will be for me for a people, and I will be for them as a God. And the question we asked right at the end of last year is, if God's removed the Yetzer Hara, why do you need to be told that everyone, that the Jewish people are going to keep the Torah? Obviously they're going to keep the Torah. If there's no Yetzer Hara, if there's no evil inclination, then obviously everybody's going to do the right thing, right? So why do you need to be told that? Why does Yechezkel need to be told that? And the answer the Abarbanel gave, the question that was asked by the Abarbanel, and the answer the Abarbanel gave was a very interesting one. He said, at the end of days, it's not going to be, it's this verse here doesn't reference the Jewish people. This verse references the world. The Jewish people obviously will keep the Torah, but the Chiddush is, the novelty of the end of days is that all the nations in the world will seek to keep the Torah. They'll be wanting to attach themselves to the Jewish people. And God says, "V'hoyu li la'om, I will be, they will be me to me as a people," meaning the whole of the planet, not just the Jewish people. "But ani ayeh lohem l'lohim, and I will be a God for them, for everybody, for the whole world." But it still leaves a question, which I just want to discuss briefly. But okay, so we've got a situation where at the end of days, God, so to speak, has removed, as Yechezkel was told, removed the heart of stone and replace it with a heart of flesh, meaning, as we described, the Gemara described it, that it's the end of the era of the Yetzer Hara, the Messianic era is the end of the era of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. But so what's the point in living? What's the point of the project? What's the point of the ongoing project? If there's no Yetzer Hara, if there's no, evil inclination and everybody's just doing the right thing, the whole thing just seems to sort of fade away. The whole project seems to be at an end and there doesn't seem to be any purpose to anything. So I just want to introduce you to a drosha here from Rabbeinu Bachaya on the Yetzer Hara, which he writes in a sefer called Kad HaKemach, which is like a bowl of flour, in which he deals in the first section with the Yetzer Hara. And he quotes a Gemara in Sukkah that lists seven names that are used to describe the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is, we perceive it as the voice in our heads that's telling us to do the wrong thing. But he says there's seven names that are used to describe the Yetzer Hara, which indicate the seven strategies, the seven super strategies, so to speak. There are many subcategories of these strategies, but these are the seven avot, major primary characteristics of the Yetzer Hara. And they are described by seven words. And the seven words are as follows. One is Ra, which is, you know, the very basic idea of evil, that the Yetzer Hara encourages, seduces a person to do something that he actually knows deep down is wrong. That's the major strategy of the Yetzer Hara. But there are others. There's something called Tomei. The Yetzer Hara tells you that there's no such thing as something that's moral or immoral. It tries to convince you that it's all a matter of perspective. What's good for one person is not necessarily good for other. I mean, for another. We have this idea in medicine. We've got doctors among us, I think. Certainly got one. Dr. Lowenthal there, but we know that, you know, one medication for one person can heal him. The same medication given to somebody else can kill him. So, and we have this idea in the world we have today, we have this idea of multiculturalism, where really there's no such thing as evil, and there's no such thing as good and moral, and there's no such thing as immoral. This is an argument that's taking place in the woke society that we live in today. So we've got this idea of tame. The XRR tells you, listen, really, there's no such thing as something that's really moral or immoral. Just whatever behavior appeals to you is appropriate for you. That's another strategy of the XRR. The third strategy is described, Rabbeinu Bachai describes it as Orel. Well, the XRR, Orel literally means uncircumcised. And he says, the XRI encourages you to believe that there's no difference between Jew and Gentile. We're all human beings. It's the humanist approach. We're all human beings after all. We're all created in God's image. And so whatever the Torah allows them to do, you should also be allowed to do it too. That's the idea of Orel. The third idea is something called Sone. The XRI is called a Sone. And the HRI encourages you to hate people that have caused you harm rather than trying to make peace with them or seeing and appreciating their position and situation. And of course, this is the prime cause of Lashon Hara in the world. But people just can't come to terms with the fact that somebody's done them harm and they feel that they've got to tell everybody about it. That's the fourth strategy of the HRI. The fifth strategy is called Michshol. The Yetzer, the evil inclination, places difficult situations in front of you, to which the resolution of that problem is very complex, and encourages you to choose the easy way out rather than think about the problem deeply and find the correct, often more complex solution. That's the fifth. The sixth he describes as Evan, stone, which is what we're talking about here. The Yetzer encourage you to believe your ego, to have a heart of stone. When the Yetzer is telling you, you shouldn't back down from your position. You should be obstinate and stubborn and never seek a compromise because you're right. A heart of stone. That's what it encourages in human beings. And finally, the Yetzer is called a tsfoni. It doesn't mean somebody from the north. It's safun, something we discuss in the Haggadah on Seder night, tsafun, which is where we hide the afikoman. Safun means hidden. And the Yetzer hides behind the veneer of your sound as your sound advisor, your conscience. Following your conscience, the Yetzer is telling you, if you follow your conscience, you can't go wrong. The problem is very often that your own conscience is the voice of the Yetzer itself. Now, what we've got here, and I'm not going to go any deeper into, well, I'll just mention the end of this drasha from Rabbeinu Bachai. He says, by employing these seven tactics, the Gemara says that the Yetzer is trying to get you killed. And the Gemara says, Omar Rav Shimon, but he quotes a Gemara here from Sukkah, Omar Rav Shimon, but Lakish, Yitzro Shel Abba Misgabra Olav, B'chol Yom, Umavakesh Lamiso. The Yetzer is desperately working every day to try and influence you in these seven ways in order to seek your death. Shinema, as the Pasuk says, quotes a passage from Tehillim, Sofa Rosh HaLatzadik Umavakesh Lahamiso. The wicked one is here inside your heart, and he seeks to have you killed. And Gemara says, Ve'il Mole HaKadosh Baruch Hu She'ozelo. If it wasn't for the fact that God helps you, Einu Yocholo. You wouldn't be able to resist the Yetzer Hara. Shinema Hashem Lo Yazvenu B'yodo V'lo Yarshienu B'hi Shofto. That if it wasn't for the sake of God, you wouldn't be able to resist the evil inclination inside of you. Now, we've got this situation here where Yechezkel has been told that at the end of days, the Yetzirah is going to be destroyed. Now, it doesn't mean all aspects of the Yetzirah will be destroyed. It means that the Yetzirah to not keep the Torah will be removed. But there'll be plenty of stuff going on. The Yetzirah will still be active inside of people when people have arguments. There'll be the Yetzirah for Michshol, for example, that people will still be seeking to find the easiest solution to the problems rather than the right solution to the problems. There'll be the idea of Sone, but not everybody, even at the end of days when the Mashiach comes, that not everybody will be able to get on perfectly with each other. And various other aspects of the Yetzirah will be removed, but certain aspects of it will not be removed. The only thing we can say for sure, says Rabbeinu Bachai, from this posuk here, which again the Abravanel describes the world without a Yetzirah, it means that the Yetzirah will be removed in terms of the fact that people won't find it difficult to keep the Torah. People won't find it difficult to keep Shabbos. People won't find it difficult to keep Kashrus. People won't find it difficult to deal with God. However, dealing with human beings will be another thing completely. And as the Rambam points out, Ha'olam Kamin Hagnoeg, that in terms of the relationship between human beings at the end of days, the world will continue as it always did. People will still get angry with each other. People will still dislike each other. People will still get into arguments with each other. And people will still say things that they later regret. But in terms of keeping the Torah in relationship between the relationship between man and God, as opposed to the relationship between man and man, the Yetzirah will be destroyed. And that seems to be the message here to Yechezkel, that at the end of days, that's going to be the Lev Even, the heart of stone that prevents a person from accepting God into his life and connecting to God. That will be removed. However, you know, Olam Kamin HaGinoeg, as the Rambam says, as far as the relationship between human beings, so we'll still get into arguments, we'll still shout at each other, husbands and wives will still have disagreements, and but in terms of people keeping the Torah and wanting to connect to God, so that part of it, the Yetzirah will have no power over you at the end of days. So that ends verse 20, ends the attempt after God has described exactly what's going to happen to in the destruction of Yerushalayim, the terrible events that will take place in Yerushalayim through this vision that has taken place through chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. The good news is that at the end of days, everything's going to be fine. The Jews will return to the land forever. There'll be a rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. There'll be the Messianic era. And the Yetzirah that prevents man from accepting God as the master of the universe, that will be removed as well. But now, as we come to the end of this chapter, chapter 11, God now goes back to discuss the people that are still in Yerushalayim. If you remember, these four chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11, have dealt pretty much with the behavior of the Jews that are still left in Yerushalayim, what their leader said to them, that God will never allow us to be exiled, God will never allow the Babylonians to conquer us, and we're safe here. And basically, Yechezkel was shown all the averas, all the sins, all the transgressions that were taking place in Yerushalayim, the 25 men bowing to the sun inside of the temple, the idols being brought into the temple. And we had the vision of Gavriel destroying Yerushalayim, an allegory to the Babylonians destroying Yerushalayim. So now in verse 21, God reverts to discuss these people that are still in Yerushalayim. And again, it's 5 years before the destruction of Yerushalayim. So he says that Aleif Shukut Sehem Atova Sehem Libon Holech Darkon Barosha. As for them, referring to the Jews that are still in Yerushalayim, whose heart is still set upon these detestable things. In other words, Avodah Zorah, their paganism, the Tov Vosehem and their abominations, sexual impropriety and everything else that was going on in Yerushalayim. Holef Darkon Barosha, I will repay them for their conduct. I'll put it back on their heads. Holef Darkon Barosha Nosati, says God, they'll all be repaid for their misdeeds. Noam Hashem Elokim. This is the final nail in the coffin from God. So again, after this break in Yechezkel's prophecy or vision of doom and gloom, to bring some bright news about the future redemption of Israel, which we just had verses 16 to 20, God now returns to discussing the Jews currently in Yerushalayim. And remember, these Jews were told by their leaders, we had this in verse 16, Asher Omru Lahem Yoshua Yerushalayim Rachaku Me'al Hashem, He Nosno Oretz L'Morosho. The Jews in Yerushalayim were told by their leaders there, yeah, it's true, the 10 tribes have been exiled, half of the population of Yehuda has already been exiled to Babylonia, but that's it. Whoever's been exiled will be exiled forever, and God will build the future of the Jewish people on us. We will be the carriers of the torch. God says not a word of it. That's not going to happen. And so God now responds in this pasuk that Alev she could say him at Tov Oseim Libam Ha'olech. He says regarding those in Yerushalayim who have no intention of giving up their pagan practices and their sexual perversions, it's all going to come back on their heads. And as we know, the destruction of Yerushalayim, the burning of Yerushalayim, the burning of the first temple, the massacres in Yerushalayim, and the survivors having to trudge off into exile, The Jews of Yerushalayim just won't accept. They're just not prepared to accept that this is going to happen to them. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God here describes them as Libom Holech. They're being led by their hearts. And the Malbim says here that the word Libom, their hearts, is a very important word here. Because God's not addressing those in Yerushalayim who are worshipping Avodah Zorah for social reasons. There were plenty of people in Yerushalayim that used to go to, you know, they used to go to these pagan festivals that were taking place in Yerushalayim for social reasons. You know, their friends were going, yeah, why not go along? It's something to do. The people that are going to be massacred in Yerushalayim is those that are Libom Holech. Those that really want it, those that really are into it, those that really, their heart's in the game. God's addressing in this verse those who worship these idols from their heart. These are the people that actually believe in their power of these idols. They're the ones that are really going to suffer here, and they're the ones that are going to get massacred. And rather, the ones that are just doing it for social reasons, even though what they're doing is incorrect, nevertheless, they're the ones that will end up in exile rather than be massacred or die of plague or whatever it is, die of famine, etc. Inside Yerushalayim. That's this language of Libom Holech. God's going to take, bring retribution on those people in Yerushalayim, Libom Holech, who are led by their hearts. They really do fancy this Avodah Zorah, this pagan. They really like it. They like the lifestyle. Now, that's the opinion of the Malbim. The Radak disagrees vehemently with this. He says, Pirusha. He says, Pirusha, but Alev, she could say, Amatova, same, ki ilu libom cholok lishnei levovos, kmoshta omar liyola over the abao. He said, the people in Yush, listen to this, see if you can find any parallels in the world we live in today. As my Rebbe always said, if you want to know what's going on in the world, look in the Tanakh. Listen to what the Radak says. He says the people in Yerushalayim were schizophrenic. On the one hand, they kept the Torah. On the other hand, they enjoyed the excitement that goes with perverted pagan rituals. So it was in their heart was split as to whom they're to pledge their allegiance to. He says this is a familiar tale in Jewish history. And it's similar to what happened when Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, was on Mount Carmel, and he challenged and defeated the prophets of the Baal that were assembled there. And they were assembled there by King Ahab and his wife, Jezebel. And this is a story from Melachim Aleph, first book of Kings, chapter 18. It says, but after Elio had wiped out the prophets of Baal, Vayigash Elio el Kolam, Elio approached the people, the Jewish people. Vayoma, and he said to him, Ad Mosai Atem Poschem al Shtei Hasifim, a very, very famous, how long, very famous expression of Elio and Novi, how long are you going to hop between two mutually exclusive lifestyles? Im Hashem Olakim, Luchu Acharov. If you believe God is God, follow him. V'im HaBaal, and if you still believe the Baal, the pagan, the idol, is God, Luchu Acharov, then worship him. Lo onu ha'am osadovo. And the people didn't say a word. Says the Radak, v'hinei libo cholok v'holei chorotzon achash kutzei miyosa. In our story, the people in Yerushalayim were not silent. They didn't have Eliyahu HaNavi speaking to them, but they weren't silent. They pinned their hopes on their idols. And therefore, God says at the end of this verse, Darkom Baroshon Nosatin Om Hashem Elokim. I will repay them for their conduct, declares God, meaning what they have sown, they will reap. They wanted paganism, so pagans will come and destroy them, and they will only have themselves to blame. So the Radak here completely disagrees with the Malbim, but the Jewish population in Yerushalayim was split between those that followed the Baal, followed the pagan, the idols for social reasons, and those that didn't, those that were, whose heart was in it. The Radak says no. The reality is that these people, the people of Yerushalayim, really enjoyed this double lifestyle. You know, you go to daven in the morning, you put tefillin on, and then, you know, in the afternoon, so you go and have a barbecue and an orgy and worship the Baal. That was the lifestyle. That was the schizophrenia that was taking place in Yerushalayim. God says he's had enough of it. And that's going to be the end of Yerushalayim. And it's interesting, the Abar Benel notes here, the literal meaning of the words Darkom Baroshom Nosati is in the past tense. Darkom Baroshom Nosati. I have repaid them for their actions. And he says this indicates, and most of the commentators agree here, that the fate of Yerushalayim, which at the time of Yechezkel's vision here is 5 years hence, it's not going to take place for 5 years, is now sealed. That what Yechezkel is seeing, or what he's seeing now in these four chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11, it is something that is set in stone. It can't be turned around. And that's it. Yechezkel can't. The only thing that can be done now is to mitigate the damage, as we'll see shortly. And this verse that we just read signals the end of the part of Yechezkel's prophecy regarding the events that are going to take place in Yerushalayim in 5 years' time. And how now Yechezkel has to understand that the fate of Yerushalayim is now set in stone. And the only thing that can really be done, as we'll see as we get to the end of this chapter and the beginning of the next, is to try and in some small measure mitigate the damage that's going to happen. And as a result, in the last stage of his vision, Yechezkel sees God's presence now continue its departure from the Beis HaMikdash, from Yerushalayim and from Yehuda, as it moves into exile, as we'll see in the next two verses, in chapter 22 and 23. So that really, at the end of verse 21 there, that really signals the end of this long, long, long vision, dream, prophecy, whichever way you want to describe it, that has taken four chapters out of the book. And at the end of it, where Yechezkel has seen everything that's going to happen to Yerushalayim 5 years from now, and he's been told that there's very little that can be done about it. What he sees next is, again, something that's going to take place in 5 years' time. By Yisu, this is verses 22-23. By Yisu ha-kruvim es kanfehem, the kruvim lifted their wings, ba'ofanim lumosom, and the ofanim, the circular angels, corresponded to them, they're connected to them, as we discussed previously. Ugvod alahei Yisrael aleihem lumala, and the glory of God was over them from above, on the Kisei HaKavod, on the throne of glory. Vayal Kavod Hashem me'al tocho ir, and the glory of God, so to speak, God's presence rose upwards from the me'al tocho ir. It's now in the middle of the city. Vayamad al-Hahar, and it rested on the mountain, Hashem mikedem le'ir, which was to the east of the city. Now, the mountain to the east of the city is Har HaZeitzim, the Mount of Olives. So we had God's presence. Originally, it's God's presence rested in the Kodesh Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies, right in the middle of the Beis HaMikdash. It then moved to the entranceway of the Kodesh Kodoshim. It then moved to the Mizbeach. It then moved to the entrance of the Beis HaMikdash. And now it's moving over the city and outside towards exile itself, as the Abarbanel describes the scene here. V'zohar novishash shevashleimus hadvorim o'ela rob nivosa shur kruim nosim es kamfeya. Yechezkel signals the end of this four-chapter vision by describing the kruvim, the cherubs, which are the chayos hakodesh, these winged, four-headed angels that held God's chariot, raising their wings in preparation for carrying God's Merkava, God's chariot, from the confines not only of the Beis HaMikdash, but from the confines of the city of Yerushalayim itself. Rotzor Loma Malachei Elyon, Ozvu Shmiras Yisrael, that this didn't just signify God leaving the boundaries of Yerushalayim and the temple in Yerushalayim, but Shemalachei Elyon Ozvu Shmiras Yisrael. It meant also that the angels that were there to protect Yerushalayim left as well, accompanying God's presence, and Yerushalayim is now completely and utterly unprotected. Shigam v'alfanim shalu umosom, shigam kein hagomim hashamayim solku hashfosom v'hatavosom el Yisrael. And also the ofanim, who were also responsible for protecting Yerushalayim, the city of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash, made their own preparations to leave with God's chariot. And so Yerushalayim, Yehuda, the Beis HaMikdash are now completely unprotected. And Yechezkel saw, so to speak, take off, the Merkava taking off from the center of the city. Latosa biyad oyev lefiva yikro, and he said, "This vision, this last part of his vision, where he sees God's presence leaving the Beis HaMikdash and the city, leaving it unprotected and at the mercy of the enemy, is the fulfillment of a prophecy that's in the Torah, and we read it quite a few weeks now, but right at the end of Vayikra." We had the Tochacha, the rebuke of the Jewish people, and in Vayikra chapter 26 in Parashas Bechukosai, God warned that this would happen. Ve'evesi aleichem cherev nikmas nakam bris. I will bring upon you an army of avengers with the sword, because they're avenging nakam bris. You broke the covenant, you broke the deal we had. And you'll be gathered in your cities. I will bring plague in your midst. And you will be delivered into your enemy's hands. And as Rashi says, and at this point, Yechezkel's vision this four-chapter vision ends. So the last thing he sees in this vision is God's chariot. Not only God's presence leaving the base of Migdosh in Yerushalayim and Yehuda, but also any protection that was present in the city, either from God's presence being there itself, or from the fact that the Malachi Elyon, the Chayos HaKodesh were present in Yerushalayim. They're all gone. The city is now open and ripe for the enemy to come in and destroy it. So exactly where did God's presence travel to, or where it went to next? As I told you before, it was in verse 18 of this chapter. We already knew by Yal Kavod Hashem Me'al Tocha Ir. This verse by Yal Kavod Hashem Me'al Tocha Ir VeYamad Al Har Hashem Mikedim Le'ir. God's presence that rose above the center of the city and went to the Mount of Olives. And says Rashi, this is the third stage or the fourth stage. It's very difficult to gauge because there are different ways of understanding. So the third stage or the fourth stage of God's departure, which will eventually lead God into exile himself, so to speak. God, so to speak, will go into exile with the Jewish people, if you remember. And then it was last week's shiur or the shiur the week before. We talked about God saying that he'll be with them in Golas in a Migdash Ma'at, in a little base of Migdash. In other words, that was the catalyst for the idea of building a shul. The first time that the Jews ever built a shul, it was called a Migdash Ma'at, like a little base of Migdash, where the idea came from God. God told them to do that, that they should build synagogues in Babylonia. And he would be present. He would be present in Golas. He would be present in exile with them. And says Rashi here, with this last part of Yechezkel's vision, it becomes clear to him that Yerushalayim is destined to be destroyed and burnt to the ground. And there was now nothing anybody could do about it, apart from, as I said, this idea of some type of mitigating circumstances, that could, so to speak, mitigate the damage, as we'll see, as we proceed with chapter 12. So where would God's presence travel to next from Har HaZeitzim? So we know that Har HaZeitzim is still technically within the confines of Yerushalayim, but the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that from the city, the God's presence, the Merkava, rose to the mountains nearest the base of Migdosh, which is the Mount of Olives, and then it went out into the wilderness. In other words, it went out into exile. It's not clear exactly that if God's presence in the exile, it certainly wasn't to the same extent. It wasn't. It was him, so to speak, but not like it was in the Beis HaMikdash. When the Beis HaMikdash was standing, God's presence was noticeable every day. There were open miracles taking place in the Beis HaMikdash every day. God's presence in the exile was nistar, it was hidden. But God, so to speak, according to Hosea, the prophet Hosea, in the fifth chapter, he describes God's departure like this. Eilech Hoshuva El Makomi. God says, I will leave and return to my place. Now, exactly where that is, so we haven't got time to learn this pasuk in Hosea, chapter 5, verse 15. And my place, if you remember, we had this a discussion on this subject earlier on in Yechezkel. If you remember, it's something we say in Kedusha every day. We say it in Davening every day. Baruch Kavod Hashem Mimkoma. But God's got a specific place. Mimkomo, we bless God from his place. We don't say Baruch Kavod Hashem Bimkomo, in his place, because we don't know where that is. So we say we bless God from his place, from wherever he is. We don't know where he is, but wherever he is, Baruch Kavod Hashem Mimkomo, from his place. So it's not clear exactly where God's presence was during the exile. But as Hosea says, Elech, God told him, Elech Hoshuva El Makomi, I'm going to return to my place, Ad Asher Yeshmu Bikshu Ponai, until they admit their guilt and seek my face again. B'tzal Lohem Yishach Rineini. When their troubles trouble them so much, they will eventually seek me out, which is exactly what happened in exile, in the Babylonian exile, as we've discussed many times. During the Babylonian exile, you might not have expected it after such a holocaust in Yerushalayim, but it triggered a huge Baal Teshuva movement in Babylonia, and they sought out God. And similarly, when they got back to Yerushalayim to rebuild the Second Temple, the first thing they did when they got there, when they built the Second Temple, was offer sacrifices to speak, atone for the sins of 850, the previous 850 years of all the paganism and all the sins and all this sexual impropriety and everything else that went on during the 850 years that they had autonomy over the land. So we don't really know where God went, but certainly part of God's presence went with them. It left the Beis HaMikdash, it went through over the city of Yerushalayim, it came to the Har HaZeitzim, and then it went into the Midbar, it went into the desert, wherever that is. God describes it as Mekomi, my place, which it could be the Olam Ho'atzilus, this place that we've got no information about, God's realm, exactly what it is, we don't know, but certainly in exile, God's presence was not revealed. And certainly we've been living 2,000 years also in that state where God's presence is not revealed to us openly. We can only imagine what it must have been like to live in first Beis HaMikdash times, when you walked in the Beis HaMikdash and you saw open miracles. You saw the sacrifices going up. It didn't matter how windy it was. The fire of the fire and the smoke of the Beis HaMikdash went up in a straight line. You walked into the Schlachthaus, the slaughterhouse where they shechted all the sacrifices, and it smelled like roses in there. There were multiple miracles that were taking place on a daily basis. Of course, human beings, as is their wont, they take miracles for granted after a while. If you see something miraculous and it takes place every day, so after a very short period of time, it's not a miracle anymore. It just becomes nature. Just becomes natural. But we don't know. We don't know exactly what happened. But Rabbeinu Bachai, getting back to Rabbeinu Bachai, who's got a lot to say on this chapter, and in his commentary on Vayikra, he makes the following observation as to why sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash have to be waved up and down. If you, the Torah is very, very adamant that when you bring a sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash, it has to be waved in a waving up and down action in front of God. Says Rabbeinu Bachai, the reason for this upward and downward motion, why they are performed when bringing a sacrifice, is to symbolize God, who raises his presence, the Shekhinah, God's presence, away from the Jewish people. As it says, it's a recognition that that God, so to speak, has got the capacity to leave, right? He comes and he goes. It all depends on our behavior. He said the downward motion of the waving of a sacrifice symbolizes that this same Shekhinah, this same God presence of God, will return to the Jewish people. It may leave, but it will always return. So the idea of waving a sacrifice inside the Beis HaMikdash up and down is to signify that whenever, so to speak, God's presence leaves us, it's always destined to return. And he quotes the pasuk from Yeshayahu. He says, Kikoma is a very famous pasuk in chapter 31 of Yeshayahu. Kikoma Hashem, Eli, God said to me, just like a lion or a lion cub growls over their prey, Asher yikore alav malei roim, or even though the hand of the shepherd gathers against him, mikolom lo yiches, from the agitated voice he is not dismayed, umehamonom lo yaneke, and from their aggression he is not subdued. Kein yered Hashem tzavokos letzva al har tzion va'al givosa. So at the end of days, the Lord of hosts will descend to make war against those that occupy the Har Habayis, the Har Tzion, the mountain of Zion, ushering in the final redemption. So that's the language that the idea of interesting idea that that's why we waive a sacrifice. The Omer, all these sacrifices, they have to be waived. It's an expression that if you waive the sacrifice up to signify that there are occasions in Jewish history and God's presence leaves us, but it always comes down again. So you take a sacrifice, you wave it up, and then you wave it down to signify that eventually God will always return. And especially at the end of days, as it says there, even though the lions and the lion cubs are growling against their prey, which is the Jewish people, surrounding the Jewish people, creating existential threats to the Jewish people, nevertheless, Kein Yered Hashem, at that point, God will come down. God will, so to speak, wave himself down and redeem and fight. And redeem Harat Zion, the mountain of Zion, the Al Givoso, and the hills around Yerushalayim. Okay, now moving on to, I think this is the final verse, no, the penultimate verse is the penultimate verse in the chapter. Yeah, the penultimate verse in the chapter is verse 24, Ba'adaber El Hagola, Es Kol Divrei Hashem Asher Hareini. And now Yechezkel wakes up. Remember, right at the beginning of chapter 8, so I'll just translate this verse 25, but Adaber, and I spoke to the people, to the elders of the exile, El Hagola, Eskel Divrei Hashem Asherani. I spoke to the elders of the exile, all the words that God had spoken to me and showed me. Now this is Yechezkel waking up. If you remember, go all the way back to chapter 8, verse 1, where all this started off. It said there, "Vayehi b'shnas hashishis, b'shishi b'chamisha l'chodesh." It was on the sixth year of exile, the sixth of 11th of the 11 years of exile before the destruction of the temple. In the sixth month, on the fifth of the month, which is the sixth month is Elul. So this event took place on the fifth of Elul. That Ani Yoshev Babesi, I was sitting in my house, says Yechezkel, I was in Babylonia sitting in my house, with Ziknei Yehuda Yoshin Lefonai. And the elders of Judea, Yehuda, was sitting before me, Batipol Alai Shom Yad Hashem Elokim. And that was where the hand of God fell upon me, and I went into this vision. That was four chapters ago. And we've had four chapters of this, and many shirim on this. And So it's taken us like a few months to go through this vision. Now, Yechezkel has seen all this and taken all this in, everything that's taken place in the last four chapters, but this has taken a split second. This has all been relayed to him. Remember, he's in a prophetic state where neither time or space is relevant. He's actually sitting in Babylonia, and he's had a dream that should take many days, many, many, many days, maybe even months to deal with. But as again, in a prophetic vision, time and space become irrelevant. And he's actually sitting in Babylonia, and the time frame for this event could even be a matter of seconds, never mind minutes. And as he describes there, this vision took place in the fifth month, the fifth of the month, the fifth of Elul. And it's 5 years, as we've discussed many times, the sixth year that he's been in exile, and it's 5 years before the temple and Yerushalayim are going to be destroyed. Now, the Barbanel makes a strange point here, which I don't really understand. He says the fifth day of the month, the fifth day of any month, if anyone can help me out here, I'll be grateful. He says the fifth day of any month is a particularly auspicious day of the month to receive prophecy. Now, I don't know why that is. The Abravanel says that, but he doesn't explain why that is. I've looked at many sources to try and determine why it is that the fifth of the month should be any different from any other day of the month. Don't know. If anybody can do some homework and maybe come back with a reason why the fifth of the month is a particular day for vision or a prophecy, I'd be pleased. But says the Abravanel, it's why this prophecy took place on the fifth of Elul, on the fifth of the month, together with the Maaseh Merkava, which if you go back all the way back to chapter one, that took place either on the fifth of Sivan or the fifth of Tammuz, depending on which way you read the first few verses in the book itself. Both these prophecies were received on the fifth of the month. So they're very, very powerful prophecies, obviously. And as I said, the Abravanel says it's a particularly auspicious day of the month, the fifth day of the month, to receive a prophecy. I don't know why. Okay. So just to wrap everything up, who were these people? Like this all started off with a visit from the elders of Yehuda, and they wanted to know. They came to Yechezkel's house in Babylonia, and the thing that most interested them was the fact that they'd been told, all the prophets had been telling them for hundreds of years that Yerushalayim is eventually going to be destroyed, and now they'd already been in exile for 6 years, and they wanted to know, and Yerushalayim seemed to be, you know, running smoothly, and they wanted to know, maybe, hopefully, or maybe God had changed his mind and decided not to destroy it. That's the question they had come to ask Yechezkel. And then Yechezkel went through this process of these four chapters of visions in which the final outcome is no, God's not changed his mind. And one of the reasons why God's not changed his mind is because the behavior of the Jews in Yerushalayim hasn't improved. In fact, it's even deteriorated since you guys left 6 years ago. But who were these people? So remembering that Nebuchadnezzar, there was really three stages of the exile took place with the Babylonians. The first wave of exile, Nebuchadnezzar was not a stupid individual, and he had very good advisors. And when he first captured Yerushalayim, and he had, at that time, he had no intention of destroying Yerushalayim. No sane leader would want to destroy a city that you could exact, who had a very large population, and you could exact a lot of tax and taxation and arnona and car tax and everything else tax, which is what, you know, invaders are interested in, taxing their subjugated classes as much as they could. So he had no intention really of destroying Yerushalayim. But he was very clever. He exiled the most important people in Yerushalayim, the most experienced, the most intelligent. He exiled the last king, which was Yehoiachin, and all the great people of Yerushalayim, including Yechezkel, and Daniel, who was a youngster, Mordechai, Ezra, the list of superstars goes on, and all the accountants, and well, maybe not the accountants and the lawyers, but the architects and all the artisans, they were all exiled at the same time. So the leadership in Babylonia was of a very high quality, and they were hoping against hope that God will, so to speak, set aside this prophecy that had been coming for years and years and years, hundreds of years, that Yerushalayim would be destroyed and maybe the kingdom would remain intact as it currently was. And this is what they wanted to know from Yechezkel. So you can imagine the crowd that in his house, the crowd in his house were, you know, superstars. Probably you could have Baruch ben Neria, who was a prophet himself, and Ezra, and maybe even Nehemiah, and Mordechai and all these people. These are the people, probably not Daniel. Daniel was maybe young at the time. But now you, and they wanted to know, they wanted to know an answer to their question. And, unfortunately, the answer that, Yechezkel has to give them is no, it's not good news that, Yerushalayim is still going to be destroyed. So what did he tell them? What was he supposed to tell them? And what, more importantly, what did he tell them? So the Metzudah David says here, Allah Gola, Alan Sheha Gola, Laman Yishalcho Adoram Likrovehem Yerushalayim. Yechezkel was supposed to give the elders of Babylonia, all the information, everything he'd seen. He was to hold nothing back because the idea was that they could pass, that the leaders of the Babylonian exile who lived in Babylonia already could pass on this information. To their families and friends who were still in Yerushalayim, as the Metzudah says, perhaps in a last gasp effort to get them to do some type of teshuvah and prevent, they weren't going to be able to prevent the cataclysm, but what they could prevent was the extent of the cataclysm. So, he told them, Kol hadvarim asher haru b'shona hashishish she'oz hu b'Yerushalayim b'mara ha'nevuah. He was supposed to tell them everything that he'd seen, all the horrors that he'd seen. It's not clear whether he was supposed to mention names or places, but the general tone of the vision, he was supposed to leave nothing out. The Abarbanel doesn't like this understanding. He says something differently here. Listen to what he says here. Very interesting what the Abarbanel says here. He says, yeah, we just find the Abarbanel. Go through what he says. But Omrabah Dabar al Agola, it's called Divrei Hashem Herani. He says, Ksav Harab Rabbein, this is the Abarbanel speaking. He says, he quotes Al Posuk, and I told that the Yechezkel speaking, I told the elders of the exile, everything that God's told me and everything that God showed me. He says, Kosab Harab Rabbeinu David Kimkri Shirim is Al Kol Ma Shinisko Lamala Mitchilas HaSeifa Va'adka. He says, he quotes the redact, the Yechezkel told him everything he had learned, seen, experienced from the start of the book until this moment in time. Midvar HaMegillah, from the story of the Megillah in chapters 2 and 3, which he was forced to eat. If you remember in chapters 2 and 3, Yechezkel was told to eat the Megillah, which had all the curses on it, Uvo al Agola Tel Aviv, and to tell them about the story that took place in Tel Aviv, Shiv Soshom, Meshamim, Shivas Yomim, and he was supposed to tell them about the trip he made to Tel Aviv, if you remember. Where he was supposed to prophesy to the Jewish people who lived in Tel Aviv. Again, Tel Aviv, the word Tel Aviv is the Babylonian town. That's where our Tel Aviv comes from. Tel means destruction or pile of rubble. Aviv means springtime. And the reason why Tel Aviv was called Tel Aviv was because the Jews who built that town in Babylonia thought Tel, Yerushalayim is a pile of rubble at the moment. But one day there'll be Aviv. One day the spring will come. Spring, the spring is time of Pesach. It's a time of Cheirus. It's a time of freedom and redemption. So that's why Tel Aviv is called Tel Aviv. So he was supposed to tell them about, all the stories that took place, up until his vision, as well as what happened in the vision. This is the way that Reb David Kimchi, the Radak, says. He was supposed to tell them about how he was supposed to prophesy to the people of Tel Aviv, but instead he sat silently for 7 days before leaving the city of Tel Aviv. That was in chapter 3. But Seito alabika v'kachas halavona, and his trip to the valley where God rebuked him for not for keeping silent, v'kachas halivna v'chikuya, and how he was told to take a brick and carve out the city of Yerushalayim on it, which was the next chapter, v'shchivoso al tzido ha'yemini v'asmoli, and how he was told to sleep on his right side for 40 days, and on his left side for 390 days while secluding himself in his house and remain incommunicado throughout that time with Dvar HaVosim, and how God commanded him to tie himself up with ropes, which again, chapters 2 and 3, with Dabar Chitin Yusa'orim, and how he was supposed to eat only wheat and barley and beans and lentils while he was shut up in his home, Bechorav Chida, and how he was told to shave all his hair and divide it into three parts and burn one part with fire, depicting the burning of Yerushalayim, and he was supposed to strike one third with a sword, depicting the Babylonian massacre in Yerushalayim, and he was supposed to scatter the other third of the all the hair that was on his head, depicting the exile of the survivors, Uvo Yerushalayim, Veshuvu Levovel, and finally how he had been brought to Yerushalayim in his latest vision, whilst they were present in his house, and how he had seen four scenes of paganism in the Beis HaMikdash, and how he'd seen the avenging angels coming to Yerushalayim in chapter 10 and 11, in chapters 9 and 10 and destroy it, and how he'd seen God's presence begin to leave the Beis HaMikdash and then the city, and after all that, how he had been returned to Babylonia. He says, I call Omar Lohem, but I call Omar as called Divrei Hashem Harani. He says, the Radak says, Yechezkel recounted everything, all these events, to the elders on his return from this vision. He says, that's not true. He says, V'li nira, shelo omazer el alamara shero b'shona shishis. He says, the reality is, I believe Yechezkel only told them about his latest vision that runs through chapters 8 and 11. Kima shero kodem l'chein yomim rabim kvar. Because in respect to all these other events that we've discussed through chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, they all happened so long ago, it would seem logical that Yechezkel would already have discussed these issues with them already. And what's vitally important to understand is that Yechezkel did not only tell them about the dark imagery that he saw in this extended vision, but that the message was mixed. He said that his message, that the message of Yechezkel to the elders of Babylonia was this: true, the inhabitants of Yerushalayim would soon suffer destruction and exile. Yischu mimeno, that be absolutely massacred. And he told them that I've already seen God evacuating himself from the city. And that the 10 tribes would remain in exile. And the current exile in Babylonia would continue. And they'd all be joined, those that are in Babylonia at the moment, they'd all be joined up with the arrival of the exilees and the Jewish refugees from Jerusalem. But, says the Abarbanel, there is some good news. Kulam ba'achris ayomim yoshuvu le'eretz Yisrael. He said that, but he told the elders of Babylon, after all this dark imagery, that there's a rainbow at the end. There's a rainbow at the end of the, somewhere over the rainbow. That at the end of days, all the exiles will return forever. V'yimol Hashem es libam ha'orel, and God will forgive them, circumcising their stubborn hearts. Lefri v'yikra kaf vav mem aleph. And he says this fits in with the psukim right at the end of the Tochacha, just like the Tochacha, the rebuke in Bechukosai, has got very dark imagery. As this vision of Yechezkel had very dark imagery, at the end of the rebuke in Vayikra, there is a brighter day, there is a rainbow. And he says, he quotes the psukim from Vayikra, that this is what Yechezkel told them. He gave them all the dark imagery. But then at the end, he told them, Afani elechi mom bekeri, I too will treat them gently and bring them back. And I'll bring them back from the lands of their enemies. If their clogged up stubborn hearts became humbled, V'oz yiritzu es avono. And that will atone for all their sins. V'zochar ti es brisi Yaakov. I'll remember my promise to Yaakov. V'af es brisi Yitzchak. And also my promise to Yitzchak. V'af es brisi Avram. And my promise to Avraham. Ezkar, I'll remember all this. V'ha'oretz ezkar. And I'll remember the land, that they should be returned to the land. V'yu lo la'om be'emes. Uber Mishpot, Uber Stocker, and they will be God's people of MS, justice and righteousness and charity forever. So it says the Abarbanel, this is the end of this vision, and it ends with Yechezkel. Have I missed our posik here? I can't believe it. I actually missed our posse. Why did no one tell me I missed our posse?
I did it on a chat.
Oh, no, you didn't zone out. I missed out the posse. Oh, gee whiz. I'll say it. I just, it's typical of me. So his vision ended, and then it says, Veruach nososoni betavienu mikastima. I was lifted up. I was in Yerushalayim in my vision, and I was brought back. Back to Babylonia, Gola, Bamara, Baruch, Elakim, with the through the Spirit of God, Bayal, Me'alai, Hamara, Shera, Isi. And the vision departed from me. And then, Ibayadaber, El Hagolas, Kol Dibrei, Hashem, Asheherani. And then I spoke, I told the people, the elders of the exile, everything that God had showed me. And the Abarbanel says, yes, the message was dark, and the Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed. But he also told them that God had told him during this vision that eventually there'd come a day, and let's hope that day is not too far in coming, where we've already been returned to Yerushalayim. And v'zocharti es brisi Yaakov, v'af es brisi Yitzchak, v'af es brisi Avraham es kar, v'or et es kar. So the Abarbanel finishes off, v'yu li lo la'om, they will be for a people, the MS, the Mishpot of Bitstocker, a people of MS, justice, righteousness, and charity forever. So that's what we got to aspire to. But there's the mixed message. So the mix, sorry, I've gone over time again. That's typical me. Just I wanted to finish off this chapter. So this four chapter vision ends with the answer to the question that the elders asked, will Yerushalayim still be destroyed? The answer to that question, unfortunately, is a dark yes. But there are two provisos. You can mitigate the disaster that's coming in 5 years' time by pleading, sending messages back to Yerushalayim, pleading with your family and friends and the people who are still in Yerushalayim to do some type of teshuvah to mitigate the cataclysm that's approaching. And number two, it's not all doom and gloom, because God got a salvation plan. It might take a few years. It might take 2,500 years, but God's got a salvation plan, and that salvation plan will definitely take place as well. So it's a sort of double-edged sword message of darkness and eventual light that he gives to the elders of the Babylonian leadership. So the Babylonian Jewish leadership. So that concludes our travels through chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. We're up to chapter 12, which is, again, an incredible chapter. All the chapters in Yechezkel are incredible. Please God, we'll start chapter 12 next week. I'd like to thank each and every one of you for attending. I hope you enjoyed this year. Please God, I will be back with you in health and happiness. Next Monday, same time, same place. Until then, Kol Tov to everybody. Have a great week. And that's all. And thank you for Larry for pointing out that, you know, I had a geriatric moment there. Is it geriatric? Yeah. An old man's moment there, where I missed out a verse. Okay.
Welcome to my club.
yeah. Okay.
A brain burp.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Let's hope it doesn't happen again. I'm sure it will. Kol tov to everybody. Have a great week. Thank you.
Yashikov.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks.